trying to get a single carbon nanotube to transport some weight up into space, I think it's extremely ambitious and very much unlikely to happen. Okay. Purely because, you've got, one carbon nanotube, although they're extremely strong, if you worked out how much weight it could carry, it's not going to be very much. Two, growing a nanotube that long is extremely difficult, technically.
But they're bundled, presumably, obviously, they bundle billions of them together.
You can make a fiber. Yes, if you wanted to do it from not a single tube, but a fiber composite, then it's... I mean, I showed you the sort of spindle of carbon fibers here. So these ones here... there's groups using these artificial muscles and making these fibers down here. So these probably could use them for a space elevator. They may eventually be able to make it long enough, but I don't know if that's the near-term goal. It's a long way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the amount... So when looking at all these mechanical properties... It's difficult because you're looking at pristine materials and they're often measured on extremely small scales. So things like graphene are measured across a sort of 2-micron drum skin like material with an AFM. Generally, when you start to make macroscopic materials, you get a lot more defects that happen to occur in them. And if you start to form a bundle, you then have to try and think about how each bundle is interacting with each other and effects like that.
You've explained that the graphene will be good for things like transistors and electronics. Will they, in due course, be suitable for engineering structures? By what you were saying a moment ago, it seems not.
Oh, no. I think that's... Graphene is... so let's put it this way. If you want to make a lightweight, ultra-strong composite, you can use carbon fiber, and you can use carbon nanotubes, and you can use graphene. The advantage of graphene is probably that it's extremely cheap in terms of you can take a natural mined graphite and a bit of chemical sonication, you can form a composite very easily. So it has potential to be much more cost effective than the other two methods in the longer term. I don't think, because of it, generally when you make them in solution, the size of the sheets are only 1 micron at most. So the aspect ratio is not very high, therefore making a composite probably wouldn't be as good as a fiber system where you have quite long asymmetric structures which give you sort of knitted composites. So, although there's a lot of hype about the transistor, it's probably seen that's one of the furthest applications that are going to come to fruition. Whereas the composites are much, much closer to market.
Can I ask, and I think I have to preface this with, I think it sounds stupid, but where do these structures kind of stand in relation to something like soot? Because that pile, you were being a bit dismissive about the pile of so-called graphene produced from graphite and sonication. To me, it looked like soot.
Soot, yeah. I mean, if you have soot, you will find nanotubes, you'll find graphites, you'll find fullerenes in them. We produce in one of our labs soot, and then we extract fullerenes from that soot. So we have academic soot, which people can. Some people that's for fullerenes. Fullerenes are made by taking two carbon rods, which you then supply a massive arc electricity across them, 100 amps or so, forming a carbon vapor. Which, when it condenses, you have lots of buckyballs, plus a lot of garbage. And then you need to separate the two out through chemistry, and that's the problem with academic soot is it's expensive to separate the academic material from the garbage because it's challenging. But you can find, I think, from meteorite impacts, carbon nanotubes have been discovered. And I think possibly fullerenes as well.
Go here first.
Two questions. You can't make the carbon nanotubes superconducting.
Let me think. Are they? I don't think naturally they're superconducting.
But if you dope them.
I'm not aware. Students, do you know if anyone's made superconducting carbon nanotubes?
University challenge.
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. I think there's some predicted forms of graphene that are doped that could be superconducting.
Because, I mean, that would be the way to make, maybe the way forward to make room temperature superconducting.
It looks...
Or not room temperature, but
yeah,
higher temperature.
It would... it's something people, I think, are active on. One of the major challenges of working with graphene is to control the doping, because you've got a flat planar surface and it loves to attract contamination to the surface. And not that it's fully bonded to the surface, but just sort of fizzy-sorbed to the surface. So getting it clean and getting the right dopants in the right place. Often predicted superconducting forms have dopants which are placed in specific locations, which experimentally is extraordinarily hard to do.
Because that way you could form wires and produce magnets, basically, superconducting.
Yeah.
But the other question is, you talk about composites, and as Rachel was referring to soot, it's black, and some of your composites are transparent, aren't they?
Well,
maybe not. I don't
for know. Mechanical strength, I guess there's some. So you can form. People want graphene composites for making shields for static electricity. So they want them conducting. So there you have a high loading of graphene in a polymer to make a conductive composite, and that will be black. People who want a strong plastic composite, which is lightweight, I think the percentage loading doesn't have to be that high.
So the more graphene you have, the blacker it is, basically.
Yeah.
And also, with the composites, you know, what are the other polymers that you're mixing a polymer with pure graphene then?
Yes, I mean, typically...
Because they've got to be uniformly soluble, haven't they? Otherwise you're going to get localised patches.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly
going to be homogeneous.
Yeah, so that's the blending is difficult. So blending it with polyethylene or something like that is challenging, because you can... graphene as a powder wants to form graphite.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get it separated. So one way is to try and help use the polymer to get in between or help keep them separated. But forming these blends is probably where the challenge is for people trying to do that research, is taking this solution of graphene or carbon nanotubes, stopping them aggregating while you form a solid composite.
So what solvent is graphene soluble in?
So there's two ways you can solubilize graphene. One is to use solvents such as N-methyl pyrrolidone, dichloroethane. So generally they're polar solvents, and it works where the polar solvent can get in and help separate out the layers with ultrasonic force.
What colour would the solutions be?
I had one around. Just
it's on the table.
Yeah, I mean, you can get... It depends on the loading. They're light brown. I mean, I would think if you really want to make ultra-strong polymer composites at the moment, people can mass produce carbon nanotubes, so there's companies who can produce a kilogram of carbon nanotubes for $100, which is, and a kilogram of carbon nanotubes would probably occupy a sort of volume of, because they're very light and fluffy. But these tubes are only suitable for mechanical properties. they're no good for the electronic properties of carbon nanotubes. So they, what you want for these great polymer composites is high aspect ratio, so it's very long, can form a sort of meshy-like network, which can then be quite robust. And then one of the downsides of the graphene is it's quite a small platelet. When you put it in solution, to get it solubilized, it generally has to be a micron or so. Whereas for the electronics and the pictures I showed from our group, when we grow them on a substrate, we can grow them this big, because you're always helping transfer it from one substrate to another. But as soon as you leave it into a liquid, if it gets too big, it will just collapse back on itself, and the layers like to adhere. So that's one of the fundamental limits of solution processing with graphene, is that, and it goes back to, I think there was theoreticians who predicted graphene couldn't exist in its form because it would want to collapse back on itself. But in essence, we never have freestanding graphene. There's never a case where graphene is floating in air or in the vacuum. It's always on a substrate or support or in a liquid or on a surface. And I think the other way to produce graphene, which is soluble in water or some other solvents, is to, this was discovered I think in the 60s, so this is how long this work's been going on for, taking graphite solid, putting it in with some sulfuric acid and I think hydrogen peroxide, and forming a graphene oxide product, and then separating that out and then reducing the graphene oxide back to graphene using some hydrazine and other types of chemicals. So people have been playing with this chemistry since the 1960s. But that method uses some nasty acids. So,
does it have any unusual properties with temperature, low temperature and high temperature?
I think it's got negative thermal expansion coefficient or something like that. Yeah, there's lots of unusual properties.
Is that like ice, where it gets bigger and the colder it gets to a certain point?
I think so, yeah. It's hard to remember every fact of graphene. So,
somebody else at the front had a question. No? Did you? Yes, no? No? Guy at the back then, please, Phil.
Is it only carbon that does this?
No, there's boron nitride. So there's a boron nitride is an insulator. It is white, so you could make a polymer composite which is transparent. It has the same hexagonal structure as graphene. It just has boron nitrogen, boron nitrogen, boron nitrogen, and slightly different packing structure. So you also have molybdenum disulfide, tungsten diselenide, and then there's a whole other range of sort of inorganic layered semiconductors. The big push now is to mix graphene with boron nitride and molybdenum disulfide. Molybdenum disulfide is a semiconductor, boron nitride an insulator, and graphene a sort of semi-metal. So you've got the three building blocks to start making vertical structures. So people have done some nice devices where you can put a semiconductor between the two metals and have an insulator in between and look at tunneling electrons through these systems. So the graphene by itself won't do much in terms of for the real electronic or optoelectronic applications. You need to integrate it with other materials. And finding an insulator which you can put down, which is half a nanometer thick and uniform across a centimeter, will change a lot of dielectrics and a lot of way of doing electronics. So boron nitride has a lot of potential, as well as molybdenum disulfide. The challenge at the moment has been growing these materials. So you can grow graphene from dog poo. You can't grow these other ones from these types of rudimentary chemicals. To grow boron nitride, you need very expensive borazine chemicals, which cost. So the chemicals to grow boron nitride, which one of my students is trying to work on, was how much? £300 for
10 grams.
So it's too expensive for us.
For somebody in the middle, did you want to? Yeah, Will.
Can you do the same with silicon, just single sheets of silicon?
Yes, that's called silicene, and that was discovered about a year or two ago. Problem with that is silicon oxidizes extremely quick, so silicene is much more difficult to work with, so you'd have to do it under UHV and do the... So the people that have been studying that have done it all in ultra-high vacuum. There is a lot of interest in doing this with all sorts of things. Yeah. Silicene has caught the physicists' attention, but mainly the ultra-high vacuum STM community, because as soon as you take it out of the vacuum chamber, it will oxidize, so you'd have to do all the processing. Whereas graphene won't oxidize. It's extremely robust, which is one of its real treasures.
I read something about graphene potentially being self-repairing. Are you talking about the kind of holes you had in your diagrams or something different?
I can answer that pretty well because that's right in my area of expertise. So when claiming it's self-healing was not quite a lie, but a bit of a misconception. So you can, when you're doing this electron microscopy, which is where this study was, you create these holes, and what these people found was in this hole, this contamination filled it up. So if you've got a dirty microscope with contamination, it produces amorphous carbon on your viewing area. So what they found was their contamination, which filled the hole in, so basically it'd be these atoms coming in to fill this hole. It originally will fill it in an amorphous manner. It doesn't... When the amorphous carbon comes in, or the carbon atoms, they don't always form this beautiful crystalline structure. But if you supply energy from the electron beam will convert it into a crystalline material. So the paper is really contamination on graphene transformed into a crystalline material by the electron beam. Okay. So the graphene's not really doing the healing, it's the electron beam. The electron beam supplies the energy to do bond rotations and to take an amorphous material and make it crystalline.
I do think it might be too good to be true. There was no energy involved in that.
Yeah. I mean, when a paper's got two Nobel Prize winners on it, it gets lots of publicity.
Sorry. Had some people on the back.
I probably... I was just wondering what the application there is from being able to put fullerenes inside a nanotube.
So they're probably as much as any fullerene application has, which is it's extremely scientifically beautiful and has actually had lots of pictures which I took out of the talk. We were doing that because we had an interest in fullerenes, which was that they can hold an unpaired electron, so a single electron which has a spin component for a very long time. So the quantum properties of the electron has a long coherence time. So these types of fullerenes, what happens is this metal donates three electrons to this fullerene shell. Two of the electrons pair up and one of them becomes unpaired. And if it's unpaired, it means you can flip the spin from a spin up to a spin down. And then you can start to play quantum games with that. So the people we were working with had ideas that we wanted to get these little fullerenes which have a nice single electron spin to form a chain of spins that could then communicate and start to interact. And so, well, how can you form a chain of spins? You can use a carbon nanotube as the template, and therefore you could think that the spins could then transmit the spin information along this axis. The problem was carbon nanotube is not an insulator, so all the spins basically get lost onto the nanotube, and so you lose all that possibility. So uses, this has one other possible use is if you took this nanotube and filled it with gadolinium-filled fullerenes, then you'd have more gadolinium for MRI contrast agent. People have claimed you could fire fullerenes out of the end of the nanotube by applying some pressure, like a sort of gun or something like that. People have also claimed a memory switch where the fullerene can hop from one position to another. But realistically, we stopped working on this, and that's because you can get lots of good research papers and they're very attractive, but there's not much you can really get out of it.
The Franklin side.
You may be about to disappoint me, but I've been carrying in my pocket for several years. It was given at the Royal Society Summer Exhibition. I was told this is graphene. Can it be graphene?
you have to give me a bit more information than that.
That's all I know.
Make it sound to people. It looks like tape to me. Who told you that? The Nobel Prize winner? Or?
Well, it was someone from a research group at the Royal Society.
I can't tell from looking at it. It's too small and transparent.
It's a criteria there, isn't it?
I don't know. It depends. I mean, if you tell me how they made it, I can tell you.
But could it be? I mean, could that?
Yeah. It's, as I said, when you write with a pencil, I could put graphene on there by getting some of the rub it on the graphite, and you'll have some graphene on there. But it'd be majority graphite. To get just pure monolayer graphene without any of the other business, you need to grow it synthetically. Transfer it across, and then the job's done. Like what I showed you with the CBD process.
Sure,
yeah. That's the only way of getting pure graphene.
But it could be impure graphene.
It could be anything. You should have got a big autographed or analysed.
We were back to sell him Sydney Harbour Bridge.
This is very strong.
You spoke very briefly about the possible health and safety issues associated with these. Are we going to find ourselves in an asbestos situation in the 90s where we come everywhere and then we go, idea.
That's what's blocked a lot of carbon nanotube research, or applications, I should say, not the research. So, graphite, we've been exposed to graphite all our lives, eating pencils, and no one ever told us it was a health risk. The problem with studying the toxicity effects of nanomaterials is often it's the real linkage between people who know what's in the sample and have produced a high-quality, purified nanomaterial and the sort of bio people who can do the accurate measurements. Often what happens is the bio people will purchase something from a company which will be called carbon nanotubes, but in essence it's 99% amorphous carbon with iron catalyst particles and 1% carbon nanotube. And they don't even know what it is and put it into a rat and put so much in until it's equivalent to me trying to eat, you know, a cupboard full of carbon nanotubes. So if you want to show it's toxic, you can just put enough into the animal and it will suffer. What's starting to happen now is people are starting to team up and do these studies a lot more accurately and starting to separate effects of toxic iron particles out from the carbon nanotube. Most people think a carbon nanotube is probably going to be asbestos-like because it has this needle-like structure. For graphene, it's labelled as an irritant, so the stuff which I passed around is quite, this stuff is pretty fluffy. If it charges up really easily, so it gets on your hands. Working with pure carbon nanotubes is even worse because they're extremely light and fluffy when they're not very pure. So they can float around in air and quite hazardous. So that's one of the reasons why I never got into growing synthetically carbon nanotubes, but the graphene I think is relatively stable. So there is, I guess, I mean, I'd be more concerned with the fullerene face cream. That would be my issue. This sort of thing, I wouldn't put that on my skin. Maybe because
I just don't believe it. Honestly, companies use so many scientific terms that are absolute rubbish. If you delve into that, all bets are nothing in there. Well, they're claiming it's C60 because it's an organic compound with 60 carbon atoms in.
It's probably C60, but my concern is C60, which is water soluble, is extremely small molecule. It can probably pass to places where other stuff doesn't go, and so understanding that requires proper studies. But these are the things I'd be worried about. But there are regulations put in place now for handling carbon nanotubes, so it's now treated with the right health and safety. So you have to wear the respirator, which is why this guy's not doing the right thing, lying next to.
Maybe dead.
He's thinking he's smiling. Yeah, I think you should always be careful about toxicity because. Things get pushed through, and so for a carbon nanotube, it you have a single walled nanotube which can be 1 nanometer and one nanometer in diameter, or you could have a multi walled carbon nanotube with 10 walls, 10 concentric shells, and can be 20 nanometers in diameter and really stiff. So they have quite different structural forms and different interactions. So, again, just the terminology of calling something a nanotube. People call carbon fibres a carbon nanotube so it can be published in a high-impact journal. So, the use of technology should be also considered.
Is there any kind of holy grail for your area of research? I mean, obviously, the issues about transistors, clearly companies are throwing a lot of money at that. That's clearly one thing. But is there anything that you guys are working on which you kind of want to find a way to do in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I think we've... All of these applications for graphene need synthetic graphene material, except for the mechanically strong composites. So any of these touch screens and LED solar cells. So to give you an idea of the funding, Europe just put €1 billion into a graphene flagship project, so €1 billion into graphene research. The UK government gave Manchester £50 million, and then another £30 million to the community for research. Predominantly all of this ends up going into applications, so especially the UK money, the Chancellor wants to see cash come out of a Nobel Prize. So they're connecting Nobel Prize, economic success. But you can't make good technology without a very good material. And the reason you don't see a Samsung touchscreen for sale is because the quality of the graphene they used was not good enough. So our main focus in our group is to make the highest quality material that's possible on a larger scale. So we're trying to make large single crystals using scalable, cheap methods, which are not non-toxic or non-dangerous to our health. And this will underpin a wide variety of applications. So that's what we've invested in. So our sort of area is to synthesize this material, so try and find the recipes to grow the crystals, characterize them accurately, measure their electrical properties, and try and feed all this back to grow. In the same way that growing large silicon single crystals made a huge impact in silicon electronics, we're trying to sort of focus on the materials quality first before trying to make technology which can be demonstrated but is inferior. So that's our sort of main aim, is materials quality, which is why carbon nanotubes aren't in the mainstream electronics industries, because of the challenge for getting the material quality high. This has been difficult.
We'll wait to see your spin-out company, presumably called Graphene Valley. Anybody else? If not, I think we'll wind up there. Thank you very, very much. Before I say thank you properly to Jamie for tonight's very good evening, just to kind of look ahead. So as I said, my flyers were nicked, but actually there is one which I managed to find and rescue out on the table next to my book of old talks, just saying what's coming up. So in May we've got How to Film Wildlife, slightly less kind of atomically based science. In June we have the properties of acrylamide, particularly acrylamide we find in foods such as chips and other fried food, and why it might be quite bad for us. And then in July we have the role of CO2 and what's really going on, according to our speaker, in the future of the planet and its climate. And that will then take us to the end of this season. We always take a break in August. We will be back in September, not in this venue, because then by then it will have closed. You will see signs here saying that Science Oxford will be closing up in the beginning of June. That is the discovery zone and the open shop. So that will be closing. I'll be slowly packing all of that away. So you'll start coming through an emptier room for the last two talks. But rest assured, we will be here till the end of July. I've yet to confirm next year's venue, and when I do, it'll go on the website. If you're not on our mailing list, please put yourself on. If you go on the front page of the website, you can find an email address to self-subscribe. And that also helps deal with change of addresses and things like that as well, if you need to. Obviously, you've got the brochures out for Science Oxford. I can recommend all their stuff is excellent. They're, for whatever age group, they're usually very, very good events, well worth coming to. And they're doing pro rata, friends, so if you want to come to a couple of events, but obviously the venue's closing in June, they can do pro rata on getting a friend's access so that you don't pay very much, and then get to come free to your events. Other than that, my big thanks to my helpers, who've been fantastic, to Jamie's students for bringing in his props, and to the man himself for a fantastic evening. Thank you very much. As I said, please do entertain him. We've got about 10 minutes of clearing up to do.
You mentioned, by the way, polymer composites. Do you know what kind of strength in PPA you get? Because usually, of course, people have had great difficulty with buffy tubes and any example can't be, you know, worse than the program was worse than epoxy.
It's not my area.
None of your graduate students.
We focus on
Yes,
well, I am. what sort of substrates?
Well, freestanding. So this is what Kane does. He took, as I said, it's not a monolith, but he charged it up. It's the only way to do it. You say it curls itself up, but if you charge it up, then it self-repels. So it will stretch itself out to straight as a two-dimensional. He's only done that like a micro on a prop. And then you can hang it in, use the equivalent of a to hang it in a bamboo, spin it, and he wants to do more like that. Some time ago, I just read it on the archive, so I was wondering if you.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm not aware of that. We can produce millions of 25
ones.
Sorry? It's just
then
getting a lot
of it. So if you're going to get them off onto a plastic substrate, presumably.
So the issue
is. But if you can get it off the copper, then presumably in several stages you could get it. The problem is charging it up because it will curl up, of course, anything of non-trivial size as soon as you get it off the substrate. That's the tricky bit. But if you really can make zillions of 20 micron cross discs,
yeah, no,
that have that something like that, it doesn't have full 100 GPA strength, but it's no good. But they have something similar to that. Okay, well, if I can, because it's all that has to be made, but there are.
Yeah. We've got pictures of millions of these domains that have grown. Basically, they'll grow from a separate nucleation point, and then you just stop the growth so that they're 20 microns. That's it.
And they're monoliths.
Yes.
Yeah, as you say, because I have observed this in what's called granular glass. I jumped up and down on my head. It is
graphic. Depending on which recipes we use, most of the stuff we grow, because we've got lots of different recipes, is two layers or three layers. How is graphite?
It's much less strong, I think, though, two or three layer always.
You just get shearing.
Okay.
So if you put it in the same charger, work out by layers, not probably storage.
No, because that's what Kate was doing. He didn't actually have, he wasn't sophisticated enough. That was one layer. It was definitely my
4 meters is not two stories, it's another story.
He wasn't charging up. I'm talking about multiple voltages and tensile strength. He did not reach that. Either the charge or the spin. He was just trying to get the first step on the way. But anyway, that's very intriguing. And
yeah.
I'll email you.
Yeah, we can definitely provide some samples. As an experiment that I find.
I only do some volcanoes, but I know people who do this with actual samples. They just did a very good technique, you know, SpongeBob's and Sam's thing. Just reading aloud a couple of people from Studio Theatre Club and Copenhagen, and not a big unit.
Structural form
factor.
There was some growth in the long tail.
That sounds plausible.
What we grow is
a little bit of cellophane, and I can't dissolve it.
I finished myself with a magnetic straw that you create defects to study them, which was to focus the electric and sputter out.
A model
layer of greed isn't really small of strength, which then stitch together at some arbitrary way as a grand boundary.
And 100 GPA.
We wanted to study those, but again, our domains are too big.
Well, you can still gaze at the IMT when I was very
young, by meteorite. By a friend of mine, was normally like just what
science taught you was things there.
So I gazed, I had this on
how
the desk. I imagine this line of films is inspired. Eventually, I should become meteorite. It might show like from the blast
mechanical problems that were extremely good.
From being inspired,
that's a major limiting factor.
Yeah,
it's a major limiting
factor. Well, in a sense, you it really is substrate. On
the
pencil
left and
point
of sitting
there.
Some of that
sort of
silicon dioxide
microscope.
A little bit more because it couples with the phone loads of the silicon dioxide, so the white range of the atoms that you scan and transfer it onto boron nitride.
Okay guys, we're going to move the tables. We're going to shift those around the back.
She has a much larger chair than that.
Show you off, and they go in that corner, I'll start doing what they say how they work. Do you know how they tip?
No.
Can I have a look? I actually And those two glasses could come into the kitchen or put in the washer.
Do you want these main chairs to be arranged in a particular way, or just...
You can see them there, so that's fine.
What's that?
Roughly where they need to be tomorrow, so just leave them.
She's going to bring back the glasses from the glass washer. And I'm just going to put them in the car. I'm going to go down the back of the thing and be back in the minute, okay? Because we need to take stuff down there. You think it's strong enough to do a two-fit thing?
Of course.
Yeah, one delivery to make downstairs and down to my car to take back from the foot. I'll go down the back. And then we'll go back way to the offices.
Okay.
If you have to move
to it, yeah, the sandwich is nice. Somebody's iPhone. Is that Rachel's?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you went to Chiang Mai.
Yeah, you
see. Tips.
Yeah.
Gave him some tips on places to go.
Oh, yeah, that's what.
Yeah.
Something?
Probably
first foot?
With the foot?
Yeah.
How big was the foot?
Ever, sorry, before I walk away with it, that's your key.